Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Happy birthday, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, who would have turned 83 years old yesterday. This hour, we will air some stretches of conversation and music from our Martin Luther King celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday. You'll hear Toshi Regan perform, Cami Anderson, the Newark School Superintendent, Touré, the writer, and others. Jamie Floyd was my co-host. And let's begin with the singer-songwriter, Toshi Regan. I mentioned from the stage at the Brooklyn Museum the same thing we talked about here just before the news today. There is no real national tradition yet for this young holiday. And she seemed to pick up on it as she kicked off the program with some talk and some song. Toshi Regan.
I think this is the unified celebration of Dr. King's Day, is that events like this happen all over the country in communities where I think that's how resistance has started, in a lot of individual communities where people come together. So maybe it's not about having a gigantic, you know, humongous birthday cake and a gigantic, fireworks, but maybe it's about us continuing to come together and remember who each other are and remember what we stand for. I think that's the best way to celebrate that struggle. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around. I shouldn't be able to get to the second turn me around. You gotta always be ready. This is not a museum song. This is a contemporary energy that is very much in need today. I go, ain't gonna let nobody, 5,000 people should have said, turn me around. Where are they? Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom. Do y'all know this song? I don't think so. Ain't gonna let nobody
turn me around.
Sing. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around.
Turn me around. Turn me around.
Ain't gonna let nobody
turn me around.
I'm gonna
keep on walking. Keep on talking.
Hey.
That's
where we got a little funny. We didn't quite know. We knew we were going to get together. We knew we weren't going to let anybody stop us, but we were not quite sure what we were going to do once we found that. We were like, I'm here.
All right. There is no sitting, spacing out, disengaged at a Toshi Regan performance. It was a great way to start our King Day celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday. She, by the way, will be doing a series of her annual birthday concerts at Joe's Pub, January 26th through 29th, for people who were engaged by that. Our theme this year was education as a civil right. And the first interview went to a very special guest named John Stokes. He's 80 years old, and back in the day, he was one of the student plaintiffs in the original Brown versus Board of Education desegregation case before the U.S. Supreme Court. That was 1954. He later grew up to be a school principal in Baltimore, and he wrote a book just a few years ago about his childhood experiences called Students on Strike. And this is fascinating because, as Stokes recalls, the point of the lawsuit was not desegregation.
Our job was not to, we went on strike. We went on strike not because of the fact that we wanted to integrate the school. We went on strike because of the fact that we wanted one building that was a brick construction that would be equal to the white building. A 16-year-old girl led us, and we pulled 460 kids out of school for 2 weeks. And our case, of course, became a part of Brown. But our case was not, we went on strike. We didn't go on strike for integration. We went on strike for equality. It just so happened that when the lawyers took our case, under the guidance of a young fellow at that time by the name of Dr. Charles Hamilton Houston, whose medallion I'm wearing, who has set the stage, he says, we're not going to file any more lawsuits for equality, because there's no such thing as separate but what? Equal. He says, we are going to try non-segregation. Therefore, these five cases came forward for integration, and we became a part of it. Our case was the only case that was student-led, and I'm proud to be one of the students, the 80 of us who are still alive.
So John Stokes, one of the original plaintiffs in Brown versus Board, will play a little bit more from that interview now. That was about a minute and a half, and here's about another minute and a half after he made that point about not being in it for the desegregation, but rather being in it for the equality of conditions in his school. I asked him to describe a little bit more what those conditions were.
Our school conditions were deplorable. We had to walk to school. My twin sister and I had to walk 4.5 miles per day. Although, you see, buses were provided for the white students, but there were no buses for the colored children who lived in those areas. They had to walk to those very close schools. The conditions were so deplorable until we decided to go on strike. Why? Because they had put up 3 tar paper shacks for us to attend school in addition to the brick building. There were 8 brick buildings for white students. All white students went to schools that were brick buildings. We had only 2 brick buildings in Prince Edward County, one for the high school, one for the elementary school. The 13 to 15 schools in the rural areas were all wood. In addition to that, the property value for the schools in Prince Edward County for the whites was $1.2 million. For the colored children, it was $875,000. Yet there were more colored children attending school than there were whites during that time. And I could go on and on.
John Stokes. We're listening to conversation and music from our Martin Luther King celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday. Another of our special guests was Cami Anderson. She's the superintendent of the Newark Public Schools. She was just appointed last year by Governor Christie because the state a long time ago took over the Newark Public Schools because they were such a troubled set of public schools. She's white. And I asked Cami Anderson about being a white superintendent of a 90% black and Latino school system, whether that's awkward or challenges her with a different kind of learning curve.
I will start with a very kind of frank analysis of how I think race plays out in education. Let's take Newark as an example. By the time students are in the third grade, we have 40% of them that are reading at proficiency on a test that anyone would argue is not that rigorous. So actually, if we were truly able to assess critical thinking and the ability to make meaning from words and to find evidence and apply it to other places, as Dr. King would define it, there I go quoting him, then we would be in an even more stark position. And there's a big gap if you look at African-American students, poor students, even among that 40%, then that number gets even more stark. So we have a very practical challenge in front of us in Newark and in cities across this country, and something I've been obsessing about for 20 years. I grew up in a multiracial family. My family, my son is multiracial, and I have a deep passion for him growing up in a world where people look at him for his ability to think, read, write critically, and believe that we have a long way to go to deliver on that. So, I've been at education for 20 years, and I feel that most folks want excellence for their children. Most folks want leaders who listen, who find common ground, but who are also bold and willing to speak plainly about some of the challenges we face. I hope I am that person and believe that regardless of my age, gender, race, that I'm able to tap into the expertise that's already in the city, but also to bring all of my life experiences, my 20 years of experiences to bear on this seemingly intractable problem.
Do you think that civil rights or social justice is a useful frame from which to approach the public education problems of today, or is it the wrong frame?
I mean, civil rights to me is basically, it's both a moral and a practical mandate, if you will. Morally, it is absolutely the case that unless you are able to think critically, read critically, write at very high levels, do numeric math at high levels, you don't have the fundamental choices that everyone else does. So I think it is morally right to frame it as a civil rights issue. Practically speaking, it also gives you access to the middle class. And more importantly, I believe we're missing out on generations of amazing leaders. If you just look at things like the leaders in our country, whether it is Congress, publishing houses, universities, they're disproportionately male and they're disproportionately white. To me, that means we're missing out on tons of talent. Tons of talent that may actually put us on a different trajectory. So I think it is the right frame, both because from a moral standpoint, our country was founded on the principle of equitable opportunity, but also from a practical standpoint, we might actually be doing a whole lot better competing with the world if we had a more diverse leadership pool, and that requires us having a better education system.
And one of the things that I'm going to be curious to hear from everybody as this discussion goes on, and I'll ask you first, Superintendent Anderson, and then Jamie, you can pick it up, is I am frustrated when I look at the broad sweep of attempts at using civil rights to improve education for minority kids and poor kids, because it's just littered with failure. Mm-hmm. I was jotting down some notes about where we've been in different decades. In the 50s, of course, was Brown. In the 60s, New York City had a huge battle over neighborhood control, taking decisions away from the white power structure with Oceanville and Brownsville here in Brooklyn at the front lines of that. There was a six-week teacher strike resisting it. Community control was declared mostly a failure eventually. Then you look at No Child Left Behind, which, though it makes people laugh, was designed in part between President Bush and Senator Ted Kennedy to take race and income into account more and not consider schools successes unless they are also successes for their poorer and more minority kids. But now people laugh when you mention No Child Left Behind. Look at the Abbott decision in New Jersey, which now you're in New Jersey. That was intended to reduce the disparities in funding in education, with the courts ruling that you can't have such spending disparities between the low-income cities and the richer suburbs. And yet here we are with stark, raving inequities. Why is it so hard for any of these things that are civil rights-based, you might argue, to have had more of an impact?
So let me actually take the question a different way and to give a couple of hopeful examples, which is to say there are hundreds of schools in this country that work with students, 90% of whom are living below the poverty level, 90% of whom are reading at grade level, and 90% of whom are doing math at grade level, not just one or two. And over the last 10 years, 20 years since I've been working in education, the number of schools that are able to achieve those kind of breakthrough results are growing fast. I find this quite hopeful because we have this big debate about whether you have to solve poverty first or education first. And my view is we cannot afford to have that debate. We have children in our classrooms right now whose lives depend on us getting it right. So we must actually reform both and not be naive to the challenges of poverty, but also acknowledge that there are very different outcomes occurring all over this country in individual classrooms and schools getting very different results. So we must be courageous enough to ask, why is that the case? And there is a lot of learning that can be mined from that. I also find it quite hopeful. And then we think about the school as the unit of the change, the classroom as the unit of change. Why do you have three fifth grade classrooms, same neighborhood, same challenges, and three radically different outcomes for those classrooms? We saw a study this week that showed the impact of a great teacher is not just about student achievement results, but about life earnings, life choices, poverty. This is incredible. To me, I find this both depressing, thank you, but also I find this incredibly hopeful. We have to look in the face and say, if you get radically different results from school X versus school Y, from teacher X versus teacher Y, this is an unacceptable outcome. Let us find what teacher Y is doing to get those breakthrough results. Let's ensure that we're replicating that and addressing underperformance. It sounds very hard to do. I mean, very simple, sounds very simple to say. It's very hard to do, but I do believe that if we take that approach, we have islands of excellence. We need systems of excellence.
Cami Anderson, the Newark School Superintendent, will be hearing more from her later in the hour as we continue to listen to conversation and music from our Martin Luther King celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday. More excerpts right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC on this Martin Luther King Day 2012, and we're listening this hour to conversation and music from our Martin Luther King celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday. Our theme was education as a civil right, and this excerpt is largely about the intersection of social and personal responsibility to make equality in education a reality and the tension between the two. This begins with my co-host Jamie Floyd asking the personal responsibility question to the writer Touré. You'll also hear the West Coast educator Vili Wong from a community group called Bay Cat in this discussion, but it starts with this question from Jamie Floyd.
So we're going back to May 2004. That's the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board, and Bill Cosby, as we now know, was invited to the gala, the NAACP gala, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the decision, and he declares, quote, lower and lower middle economic African American people are not holding their end of the deal on education. And so he began in his talk there to turn scrutiny away from the courts and the political process and even the school systems for perpetuating, quote, still separate and unequal conditions, okay? And then he goes on, and this is the part of the quote that got all the attention back then. Brown versus Board of Education is no longer the white person's problem. We cannot blame white people. It's not what they are doing to us. It's what we're not doing. 50% of dropout. That's what he said. And it's not just Cosby. 2006, Fox News contributor Juan Williams, quote, young people of color are failing Brown by failing in school or by dropping out. Congressman Herman Badillo from the Bronx, education is not a priority in the Hispanic community, he wrote in 2006. In his book, he writes, Latinos have been on a 500-year, quote, cultural siesta that has led to lower educational levels rather than more economically and socially successful immigrant groups have achieved. And then I could quote John McWhorter, but I won't. Just because I'm running out of time and I have a producer in the back who'll get in my ear. But John McWhorter has actually participated in this event, this very event, the MLK WMYC event, and he, I know, Touré, you write about hip-hop. He basically says, let's pull up our pants, stop listening to hip-hop, and put our nose in the books. Okay, so basically, Touré, it seems to me that what they're all saying is that since the legal segregation of schools is no longer the law of the land, we can't keep pointing to the system, for our failures. So is it fair to say that our failures as a community fall squarely on our shoulders, generally, and on our young people, specifically? Yeah, I went to Ray first, Billy, but you're not off the hook.
Yeah,
in the inner city over on the West Coast, so we'll come to you in a minute. To Ray, your response.
There's no simple answer to that, and I certainly am not going to indict the entire community, because there certainly are people, young people and parents, who are very engaged and dying for education and understand that education is the way out. But one of the things that I found in doing the research for my book was that there is a way that you see that the students, the young people, are not understanding of the value of education, in that they are penalizing socially black children who try to succeed academically. And that studies from Roland Fryer at Harvard, which talk about black children at the top of the grade point scale have fewer friends than white children at the top of the grade point scale. And as you go up from 2.5 to 4.0, they progressively have fewer friends, as opposed to white students who increase in friends. So the white students are gaining social power as they go up and do better in school, and the black children are losing social power as they go up in school. And you can imagine being 15 or 16, that social thing is so important. And some students make the wrong choice, and they choose to be social and to have as much social power as they can get and sacrifice their education to get that social power. This is not a choice that is acceptable for a 15 or 16-year-old to have to make, because they often cannot make it intelligently. So that is one of the most frightening things to me, and an example of the crabs in a barrel phenomenon, where we are not fully taking advantage of the potential to succeed and where education will take us. So there are ways, yes, that, and you know, I hate to agree with those, that cabal of people, but if you say, you know, well, this person, I disagree, so then I disagree with everything they say, well, you know, then you're going to be playing intellectual twist, or even a broken clock is right twice a day. So there are ways in which we are complicit in damaging ourselves in the educational arena.
But does it not, Vili, some of what they say may be true, but does it not fail to take into account the reality, some of what we talked about in our pre-interview, also known as dinner last night, does it not fail to take into account the social realities of mom working three jobs and the pressures of or no mom or the pressures of a three-home family as opposed to a two-home family, or having to travel from the East Bay to the South Bay, Vili's in on the West Coast where Bay Cat is. Talk a little bit about the realities that some of these children are dealing with when they come
Absolutely.
To you for their arts education.
Yeah. Thank you, and it's a real honor to be here, and I like to see so many educators in the crowd. Just to give you a couple of contexts, you know, I'm a kid who grew up in New York and basically went through the public school system, became a lawyer, got to work with Jamie, but became a school teacher. The hardest job I ever had in my life was to be an elementary school teacher. In that vein, you know, our youth, we teach the digital media arts both in the schools and after school, and I believe media perpetuates some of these stereotypes. We had a kid in high school who basically did a film called Why So Low. The statistics show that if you're not reading at grade level by second grade, you're probably going to end up in jail. At this school, which is a large African-American population school, three high schoolers, males, graduated 2 years ago. Three. So I could grossly stereotype and say, well, is it the kid's fault? We see these kids every day. I could show you number of kids who love hip-hop, and guess what? They're getting A's. It's not about the color, what they're listening to, how they're dressed. Of course, I do tell them to pull up their pants. It gets a little embarrassing when they're in front of a client, you know. But what we do see is that the issues are so complex. We have parents who care so much. We know that. I saw that as a school teacher. But you can't ask them to take off their jobs to come and have a one-on-one about an issue that's going on. Multiply that by 100. Multiply that by 1,000. I think, you know, the heart of this question also goes to what you were saying, Brian, and what you feel frustrated about. We feel that every single day. And I think it's much more than a civil right. You know, actually, the UN adopted the Declaration of International Human Rights, right? Education is a human right. Every person on the planet should have education. So when you get to that, let's go back to the kids. Let's go back to this question. When a kid sees what their potential is, what are they looking at? We continually perpetuate in our media, and the parents buy into it as well, that, you know, you need to go to college. But what do we actually give them as far as the tools to really prepare them? And I believe in public school, and I believe the school day is so, so important. But everything from after-school programs to even prenatal care, parents who are about to have kids and they're 13 or 14 or 15, Are they, you know, we're perpetuating the cycle. So no, I can't affirm those kinds of quotes because we can't just grossly stereotype, you know, what the issues are. And I think that goes to the solutions. As we think about what the possible solutions are, the stakeholders are many. The other people on this stage should be corporations, should be foundations, should be corporate America. You know, people who are out there, we all have kids, and we all put them through education. And it matters what zip code you're in and who you're born under, right? And so all of us are stakeholders to this problem. And I think about talking about evening the playing field, every day we see examples of hope. It's those little things that you just said, Cammy. I try to focus on the kids who are making it and have them be the beacons, be the peers. It's more important that they say to their peers, you know what, I want to go to City College, but I had a really hard time, and this is how I did it. So let me help you, you know, teenager. If you're a 20-year-old, you should be helping the teenagers get to college because you just figured it out. Right? So I believe there are possibilities for solutions and that we have to not focus on those stereotypes, but focus on those success cases and to broadcast those stories.
Villy Wong, why do you think there is such a culture war over charter schools? You know, you could see the movie Waiting for Superman, which includes a kid from a poor community who really wants to learn, and he is crushed at the end of the film when he does not get chosen by lottery for one of the scarce slots in the charter schools. You know, but then you have people who are so incensed that this is somehow a conspiracy to destroy public education. Is it more, from what you could tell in your community, more than just the teachers' union trying to protect their prerogatives?
Having been a teacher, that's a very loaded question. You know, we see it from a lot of different perspectives, and again, speaking personally, you know, when I started BayCat, I actually looked at all the different models and considered, for example, starting it as a charter school. And as I started researching and dissecting, well, who's doing really well in education, I actually ended up in the same place that Cammy just did, which is it's really, again, hard to generalize. There's a lot of really great models. So knowing that there's resources there, then it becomes the question of how do you connect the dots between the parents and the students and actually getting to those resources? So we have done experiments where we have taken our digital media class, gone to the housing developments, found a room that was burnt out, outfitted it, brought state-of-the-art Apple equipment, and you could have a totally loaded classroom, and the kids will be at the doorstep, and they won't necessarily walk in. What is the source of that problem? Is it just the schools? Is it a culture thing? It's very, very complex because you have to show success. You have to show that there's a reason to show up in this classroom. There's a reason to show up in school. There's a reason to graduate. The metrics in our culture right now are, yes, go to school, graduate. But I can tell you in 1 week, I had 5 students from our class that we knew at BayCat who called me and said, I'm dropping out of college. It's no longer enough to just get them through college. And culturally, they were across the spectrum. They were kids who had working parents who went to college. They were also kids who were the first to go to college. So when we see that day after day after day, I really ask everybody in our community, I always say, you know, it takes really great people. We need good people everywhere. And when you see a child in need, the best thing that we could do as citizens is to connect the dots and really get young people to the resources that they need. We also know, and we just got invited by the James Irvine Foundation to be part, this is more hope, to be part of a conversation to see how you could build that network. Because if a kid doesn't have a home, they're not going to be thinking about school. If they have a home, but they can't afford tuition, they need support services. If they have emotional issues, if they have a learning challenge, oh my goodness, right? So I feel like how do we address this? The best that we could do on a day-to-day basis is really to educate ourselves and to connect the dots with our young people. When you see a kid in need and before you pass judgment that their pants are below their waistline and, you know, on their thighs, most kids want to succeed. They want to be empowered. We see that every single day. And the minute you put a microphone, a camera, something that empowers them to tell their own story, they're there. They're present. And I hope that we see that every single day and that we're able to connect the dots in that way.
West Coast educator and media literacy educator Vili Wong, with Touré, the writer, Jamie Floyd, my co-host, and me at our Education as a Civil Rights discussion for King Day at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday. And continuing on the same themes, here is about a three-minute exchange between Touré, whose current release book is Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness, Touré, and the Newark School Superintendent, Cami Anderson. Anderson speaks first.
The idea of creating a pure culture of accountability in schools and in classrooms is critical. I agree the hardest job I ever had was being a teacher, and I taught all students who had been suspended, who had been kicked out of their class. I was the new teacher who didn't know any better to say no, right? But then I requested that class the next year, and we ended up getting one of the largest gains in the system because my basic operating assumption was as follows. You can teach good decision-making, conflict resolution, studiousness, organization, backwards planning as a way of getting to college. You can teach that as purposefully and as successfully as you can teach mathematics and writing. And I also think a missing link in this proposition that you raised is that we talk a lot about rigor. We talk a lot about curriculum. I actually think the Common Core standards provide a real hope. Teach less, really, really, really well. Big idea. Great idea. One thing we haven't talked very systemically is how do you teach social and emotional skills in a very systematic way? And you can. You can do it. So part of it is, you know, if you're a teacher, you show up at a kid's door, they don't come to school. Let me tell you what, they get to school the next day. So you don't have to also prosecute the parents. I had one kid who was absent 2 days in a row, showed up at his house. Like, oh, Miss Anderson will come to your house. You better get to school. You also get the students involved in their own campaign, charting their attendance, charting each other's attendance, making deals with one another. So there are ways in which to create a sense of urgency, shared accountability, peer culture, and to address in a very sort of systematic, teacher-like way some of the social and emotional pieces. And something the school reform movement, I think, could do more of is actually talk about how do we teach reading really well and not, you know, sort of say if you're not reading by the third grade level, well, let's start building prison cells. But also how do you teach decision-making? And how do you teach a college-going culture? And how do you create a sense of urgency? Great schools do that. Great teachers do that. And so if we can figure out how to extract those lessons and spread them, then I feel it's a very hopeful and it's much more likely, in my opinion, to have the desired outcome that we're seeking.
Is it there in the schools?
About decision-making, and we teach kids so many important things and how to think and how to learn, and I wonder, however, if we shouldn't be also teaching them financial education.
Okay.
You go through high school, college, never be told what an IRA is, never be taught how to save, never be taught about how to deal with your money. And that's so crucial.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact that there are businesses that have been built on the backs of our poorest citizens with regard to higher ed. And so our president has taken a very courageous stance on this. 90% of Newarkers who go on to college have to go into remedial courses. Remediation is a spin cycle that most young people never get out of. They go to college. We tell them they have a high school diploma. They get there. They cannot progress. And now they're in college and they're in debt. They drop out, and they're in debt. Talk about a financial double whammy. So there's so much that we need to do with regard to, one, being honest, a high school diploma should mean college ready. That's number one. It has to mean college ready. And number two, this whole piece about remediation is as much about an entire business approach to making money on the backs of our poor citizens. It's not acceptable, and it's something we have to address.
Cami Anderson and Touré. We're listening to conversation and music from our Martin Luther King celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday. More in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're listening to conversation and music from our Martin Luther King celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday. Some of the best moments came from student presenters. Eighth graders at the Manhattan Country School, that's a private school on the East Side, founded in the 1960s to further the work of Martin Luther King. They have a sliding scale tuition by ability to pay, and they stage a march every Martin Luther King Day. That's their annual tradition, on which they give speeches around the city the kids do, about different aspects of civil rights. So this is eighth grade student Emma Morgan Bennett reading her piece on the theme of education as a civil right.
These days, education is everything. Without an education, many opportunities are lost. The modern world knows that education equals success, yet we still deny so many their educations, and therefore we deny them opportunity as well. Worldwide, 101 million children are not in school. In countries all over the world, young children are denied their educations. They live in poverty and most likely will never get an opportunity to start a new life until they are educated. In Liberia, for example, 61% of children are not in school. Uneducated young girls, especially, are prone to incurable diseases and suffering abuse. The United Nations declares that universal education will speed progress towards all development, but the youth of today remain undereducated. These children suffer not knowing how their lack of education will affect their future lives. Being undereducated increases the risks of contracting HIV or AIDS, suffering abuse, and continuing to live in poverty. With only 27.6% of our world's population attaining education through college, how can we expect youth around the world to escape this trap? For children of developing countries, education is especially necessary for survival. By learning to add and subtract, they can learn how to count money, a vital tool in owning a business. By learning how to read and write, they can start on their path toward becoming educated citizens. These basic educational necessities will pave a road to a good future. Yet education does not stop at numbers and letters. After receiving these lessons, they must educate themselves in citizenship. They and we must learn how to make our own judgments in order to pave a road for our future. Reading and mathematics are the start of an education, not the end. An education is not completed until you have combined all you have learned and turned them into an ethical path. The most important lesson I have learned is that education is not just learning about mathematics, English, and history. Without turning numbers and letters into life lessons, they are just skills, but they are not tools. Education should combine every aspect of your knowledge and create an ethical compass. For through education, you must see the world and take action. For as Martin Luther King said, the function of education, therefore, is to teach one to think intensively and to think critically. But education which stops with efficiency may prove the greatest menace to society. The most dangerous criminal may be the man gifted with reason, but with no morals.
Eighth grade student Emma Morgan Bennett from the Manhattan Country School, presenting on education as a civil right at our Martin Luther King celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday. I want to play an excerpt next from Frederick Harris. He's professor of political science and director of Columbia University's Center on African American Politics and Society. He has a book coming out soon on the Obama era in America. But we talked so much about K through 12 education, as you've been hearing if you've been with us this hour. He answered a question from the audience about the cost of college.
Higher education is increasingly out of reach for most Americans. And I think our country depends on the future of our country depends on how much access that ordinary people have to education. I think one of the most brilliant things that this country has developed in the realm of education is public higher education, which is increasingly becoming much more privatized and out of reach. And I think in many ways there's going to have to be some reforms around public education. I think, for instance, the great educational system of California, we were talking about this. How much did it cost for an ordinary person to get an education at the University of California at Berkeley in 1950s, right? It's virtually free, right? And we all know about the story about the city of New York system, right? It was free for many years, for most of its history, I suspect. And I think that, we have to get to this idea that public education, higher education, should be a right of every citizen.
And here we are, as I made this point on stage yesterday, in a country that is formulating its economic policies around the idea that the low-wage, low-skill manufacturing jobs are going to be performed in China and other countries, that our future economy is supposed to be based on an educated population doing relatively high-skill jobs. And yet it is not really the national policy of this country to make sure that every American child or nearly every American child gets that higher education, even as national policy is for the economy to pretty much require it. And when President Obama recently said that he would like to see every child in America get a college education, there's been a lot of political blowback against him for raising that. So that thought, and Frederick Harris, professor of political science and director of Columbia University's Center on African American Politics. We are listening to excerpts from our Martin Luther King celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday. Rachel Moran, law school dean, was brought in on the question of hope. And it's funny about Dr. King. He, ironically, did not speak that much about education during his life. We really realize this fully when putting this program together. You know, you always look for the great Martin Luther King quotes, and there just were not many Martin Luther King quotes about education. It just wasn't his emphasis. And the timeline was that Brown versus Board of Education, 1954, came before King's real heyday. So in a way, Brown created King more than King created Brown. And those King quotes that are around have more to do with the philosophy of what education should be for, like student Emma Morgan Bennett's statement, than protesting against unequal resources and things like that. Here, if you Google King education quotes, what comes up on 90% of the hits is this: the function of education is to teach one to think intensively and to think critically. Intelligence plus character, that is the goal of true education. Intelligence plus character, that is the goal of true education. So certainly a lofty thought, but not in keeping with the Poor People's Campaign and these other demonstrations for equality and campaigns for equality that King was most known for. Just an interesting point. And that brings us to Rachel Moran. She's dean of the UCLA School of Law. And after hearing things like the last clip, Frederick Harris, on barriers to higher education, and hearing about some of the other problems that we were talking about this hour, Rachel Moran was asked, is there hope? And if Dr. King was around today, how pessimistic would he be, and how hopeful would he be about the future of equality and public education?
Dr. King, on the last day of his life, gave a speech in Memphis. And in that speech, he said that he had been assaulted by someone when he was doing a book signing. And the newspaper's cover story was that if he had sneezed, he would have died. And he got letters of condolence and, you know, hopefulness from lots of people. But the one that he remembered was from a schoolgirl who said, Dr. King, I'm so glad you didn't sneeze. And he said, I'm so glad I didn't sneeze either, because I have lived to see the tremendous advances of the civil rights movement. And it was as though he knew that his death was near, because he said that he was under threat. And yes, long life is a good thing, longevity is great, but he said, if I die now, I can die happy, because you took me to the mountaintop and I have seen the promised land. Yep. And he said, whether you get there with or without me, you will get there. And what he meant was that the idealism that he had at the beginning of that movement had been tested in the crucible of adversity, and it was truer and purer and sweeter than the kind that comes from naive faith. It is the struggle that ennobles us, and I believe he thought that whatever happened to him, we will struggle on, because we are a great democracy with a foundational creed of equality and liberty and justice. And it may be hard to get there, but we have made progress. We will continue to make more. But he reminds us that the responsibility is not that of Dr. King. It is all of our responsibility. You don't have to be a doctor or a lawyer or a minister to pursue justice so long as you keep that commitment close to your heart and are willing to act on your conviction. So I think he would be hopeful.
Inspirational words of hope as we came close to the end of the program yesterday. Conversation and music at our Martin Luther King celebration at the Brooklyn Museum. That was Rachel Moran, Dean and Distinguished Professor of Law at the UCLA School of Law. She is also the co-author of Educational Policy and the Law, which was recently published in its fifth edition, as our theme yesterday was education as a civil right. But that wasn't quite the end. We ended the show with an original musical number from the Manhattan Theater Lab, one of New York City public high schools, one of the New York City public high schools, located on the Martin Luther King Jr. campus in Manhattan. Here's an excerpt from the stage musical A Song for Martin, written by their principal, Evelyn Collins, and Mr. Greg Payne, their director, who is in the house directing the group. The song is called Rosa, Sit Down, featuring the ninth grade chorus and solos from junior Sabrina Boyce as Coretta Scott King and sophomore Monty Barnett as Martin Luther King. We've been listening this hour to conversation and music from our Martin Luther King celebration at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday. Thanks to WNYC's amazing Brenda Williams, the Brooklyn Community Foundation, and others for making our sixth annual King Day celebration at the Brooklyn Museum possible. The producers were Alex Goldmark and Christopher Johnson. Great work from them. Ed Haber and the team, as always, did the sound, and you hear how good that was. I'm Brian Lehrer.